Calling all SGPS members, CFRC 101.9 FM is going to referendum this year to seek continuance of its optional student fee. Help your campus radio station serve our community with news, music, arts programming, podcasts, and more. Watch your emails for ballots from the SGPS and vote yes to continue CFRC's optional fee on January 29th and 30th. Thank you for your support.
Are you looking for a summer or part-time job? On Tuesday, January 28th, over 40 employers will be in Bartlett Gym in Mitchell Hall. All Queen's students from all programs and years are invited. All students who attend will be entered into a draw for a $50 gift card to the Great Lakes Museum. Students are encouraged to sign up in My Career to receive event reminders.
Hello, and welcome to the Queen's Law Hour. Today we will be airing an encore presentation of two episodes of our Certificate in Law podcast that were done in 2019 and 2020 with Blair Crew, Executive Director of the Queen's Law Clinics and Director of Queen's Legal Aid. In these episodes, Blair and the host, Matt Shepard, discuss legal issues facing Queen's students today and how Queen's Legal Aid can help provide support to students when dealing with the law. In the first episode, the pair discussed the University District Safety Initiative, busting some myths, and also looking at the related nuisance party bylaw. In the second half of the hour, the two meet again to talk about getting the whole picture of landlords, leases, and the law, and how it pertains to students. We hope you enjoy this encore presentation.
Welcome to Fundamentals of Canadian Law. I'm Matt Shepard. We're recording this podcast as part of the Certificate in Law, here at Queen's Law, the law school at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario. A few years ago, the City of Kingston introduced some measures designed to curb some of the excesses of student life, especially at certain times of year. The creation of new powers to govern partying in the city, with special attention on students, has obviously attracted the attention of Queen's Legal Aid, the law school's clinic dedicated to supporting students and residents with low incomes in a wide variety of legal matters. The director of Queen's Legal Aid, Blair Crew, joins us this week to talk about the University District Safety Initiative, busting some myths, and also looking at the related nuisance party bylaw. Even if you're not a Queen's student, this is worth a listen, as more of these kinds of bylaws continue to be drafted and introduced in various jurisdictions across the country. Fundamentals of Canadian Law is brought to you by the Queen's Certificate in Law, the only online certificate in law offered by a law faculty in Canada. You can find out more at takelaw.ca. Blair, I thought we could talk about some of the myths surrounding the University District Safety Initiative and what, from your vantage point as the director of Queen's Legal Aid, kind of what you've heard out there that might be misinformation that's worth correcting.
Absolutely. The University District Safety Initiative is an initiative on how certain offenses are prosecuted, but there are a number of misnomers right within the name itself. One of them is that it only applies to the University District. The City of Kingston chose to name it that with reference to the area where most frequently it is invoked, but there are no set boundaries for the University District. The initiative makes it clear that it can apply anywhere in the city at any time. So it's not as if anybody can look on a map and say, oh, we're just outside the border. We're safe. We're not caught by this.
Right. And I mean, that makes sense because there isn't officially a university district. Like I couldn't say with accuracy, it's Albert down to Barrie from X to Y. So it has to apply across the entire city.
There certainly is an area that the city associates or the university associates as being the student housing area, but the policy of the rule is that it's going to apply more broadly than that, and they didn't want to define precise boundaries as to where that was and was not going to be.
Okay. So East End, West End, all over, anywhere in the city of Kingston, this applies?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Apart from that, there's also a myth in the notion that it only applies at certain times of year. Specifically, the University District Safety Initiative does say that it's the initiative that is going to be applied during orientation week, during homecoming, and significantly around St. Patrick's Day. However, the University District Safety Initiative and its way of prosecuting offenses catches any conduct that is caught under the related nuisance party bylaw, and it's not restricted to those times of year. So it's not as if you're one day before St. Patrick's Day or one day after or the Saturday closest to St. Patrick's Day that you are necessarily safe. You can still be charged with the nuisance party bylaw, and it can still be prosecuted under the University District Safety Initiative.
So it's anywhere in the city and any time of year. It is not gated to specific times of year that have been problematic in the past.
That's correct, with a particular ability to apply it at those three times where the underlying offense is either under the Liquor License Act or the City of Kingston Noise Bylaw.
So you're naming two offenses there. Can we break those down one at a time?
Sure. And in fact, the University District Safety Initiative applies to three offenses.
Oh, okay.
So the three offenses are the Liquor License Act, the City of Kingston Noise Bylaw, and the City of Kingston Nuisance Party Bylaw. All three offenses will be prosecuted under the procedure that is provided by the University District Safety Initiative.
I actually thought the University District Safety Initiative and the Nuisance Party Bylaw were the same thing until now.
They're actually separate things.
Another myth busted right out of the gate.
Absolutely.
So let's break these down one at a time.
So the Liquor License Act, that is a province-wide act. It's probably the one under which we see the most charges that are actually laid. The primary offenses under that act would be any minor having alcohol at any time, and what's best known for this is the open alcohol in a public place. We see the most charges laid under that. Under normal circumstances, that's subject to the fines and penalties that are specified by the province in the Province-Wide Liquor License Act, but the University District Safety Initiative takes over to say that in the City of Kingston, at those times of year that I outlined, they're going to be prosecuted under that procedure.
Can the city do that? Can it just sort of say we are adding additional powers to the powers of the province to kind of do our own thing in addition to what the province does?
It's actually a question that I took a close look at because I would love to find a way to challenge the wide use of some of these powers. However, the Municipal Act does delegate to the city wide powers to regulate of matters of a city's concern. So absolutely they are entitled to supplement or to provide a code of procedure, if you will, for existing provincial offenses. And as the City of Kingston has done, they're also free to enact their own bylaws to create offenses that could be used under that initiative.
So the city does have the power to kind of take something that the province has and then put their own spin on it. May not be the best language, but they can basically, they are given the power through the Municipalities Act to kind of dial up and reinforce and enhance something that's covered under provincial law.
Absolutely. And the University District Safety Initiative specifically provides that if you get charged with an offense that would normally simply be a ticketable offense, that instead you're going to get a summons to attend a court. That's the outstanding feature of the University District Safety Initiative. It's much more inconvenient for students because instead of simply paying the set fine, they are required to come to court.
Right.
And if they don't show up in court, then there's going to be a trial in absentia. And one of the features about this is that it removes the provincial or city set fines that normally you could pay, just not disputing liability. It requires you to come to court instead. And once those fines are removed, now you're subject to the maximums under the Act, theoretically. The reality is nobody ever gets near the maximums. They're ridiculously high, but you do see that amounts that are higher than if you had simply had an ability to pay a set fine. Interestingly enough, I wondered where the city had the authority to do that, but it's a little known procedure that is available under the Provincial Offenses Act, where even minor offenses can be initiated by issuing of the person who has been charged with a summons instead of simply giving them a ticket that allows them to simply pay the fine.
So the summons isn't just a way to kind of add annoyance and more burden to the student to discourage them. It's actually kind of a gateway to a higher threshold of fines and punishment than the city would normally have access to.
That's right. Most of us are familiar with something like a speeding offense, where one of the options that you get is it will calculate what the fine you need to pay is, and you simply have the option of not disputing it, paying the set fine, signing that you're guilty, sending in your check or your MasterCard payment, and then you're done. By requiring students, usually, to attend court, it removes those set fines and subjects the students to higher possible penalties.
Right. A quick side note, just because you just used the word students, similar to the fact that this takes place anywhere in the city and at any time of year, it is not just something that is applied to students. This could theoretically apply to anyone of any age.
Yeah, they could not make that discrimination in the act.
Right.
Everybody knows that it is aimed primarily at students. It is called the University District Safety Initiative, after all. The target is very, very clear. So I use the word students. The vast majority of people that we see that are charged with the offense are, in fact, students at Queen's and occasionally at St. Lawrence College.
Right, because, I mean, you'd be running into significant charter problems if you tried to make a law that just applied to people of a certain age.
Yeah, I looked for that and hoped that we could see it in order to challenge it. Sadly, it's not there, and they've been a little bit more clever than that in the way that the legislation has been drafted.
Right. So is that everything on the Liquor Act, or is there more stuff to cover there?
That's the essential thing. It's the open alcohol is the big one. Public intoxication is another offense under the Liquor License Act. It's often one that we see charges laid.
So number two.
Number two is the noise bylaw. The noise bylaw basically specifies that any noise that is audible from the street is unusual noise that is subject to a violation of the noise bylaw. There are two ways that the bylaw works, one of which is that if it's above a certain decibel at set times of day, typically after 10 p.m., then it's automatically, typically before 10 p.m., it's automatically an offense. However, any noise that is heard from the street after that time is automatically deemed to be a noise bylaw violation.
Okay.
One of the things that's exceptional about the noise bylaw is that it also carries, you know, it will be prosecuted under the University District Safety Initiative, and the fines are often in the range of $500. The bylaw specifies that the fine can go as high as $10,000, but for a first offense, a $500 fine is really quite high and well beyond the means of many students to be able to pay it readily.
So let's break that down a bit. I mean, my limited experience with homecoming, for instance, a noise that's audible on the street, I mean, the noise is often on the street. The source of the noise is actually on the street. So how does this work in terms of deciding what is or is not noisy?
Well, so really the primary way that it's used is to enforce effectively a time curfew.
Okay.
And the goal of the bylaw is we don't want to disturb people when they're sleeping.
Right.
So, to that end, after a certain time, any noise that you can hear from the street can attract if the party is in fact on the street, then that's de facto going to be a violation of the City of Kingston noise bylaw. I guess the law is also designed that unless you have a permit for it, even during the day, if your noise is simply too darn loud, then you can be charged under that as well.
Okay.
There are exceptions, and you can apply for a permit to be allowed to exceed that noise level for particular individual events.
Right. And so what's the trigger for this? Does someone actually have to call in a complaint for this to be activated, or is it just kind of passively waiting for noise to happen?
There are no requirements that somebody phone in a complaint, although frequently that is the way that it occurs. The city will respond if they get a complaint that my next door neighbor is hosting a very, very loud party.
Right.
Particularly if it's after that 10 p.m. time.
I live on a street with a band. The band loves to practice. They are not a good band, but they love to practice, and they love to practice late. So my hand has drifted towards the phone many times that I've never actually made that call.
Well, you'd be delighted to know that subject to what you want your relationship with your neighbors to be like, you do have an ability to phone the City of Kingston and ask that they come and enforce that noise bylaw.
Okay. For the purposes of this conversation, it's not actually, you don't have to have a complainant to be violating the bylaw.
No, and we've seen several examples where what happens is the City of Kingston police will be outside just around that border time, and then we'll start enforcing the noise bylaw as soon as it goes after. So they are their own witnesses to the fact that noise is audible from the street. Again, particularly in the downtown housing area,
right?
They seem to be ready at times, particularly at the times when the University District Safety Initiative is in effect, to go and pounce on any noise that they hear that's loud.
If you're having a party and the party has spilled out onto the street and the clock strikes 10:01, Who's the originator of the noise in that case? Is it anyone and everyone that happens to be around the area? Is it the owner of the house that they deem the noise to be coming from? How do you figure out who's responsible?
Well, this is where the nuisance party bylaw, the third of our three statutes or laws, kicks in.
Okay. Well, let's take a quick break, and then we will get back and start digging into the nuisance party bylaw.
All right.
Hey, it's Matt. Our conversation with Blair digs into a few interesting areas. Criminal law, obviously, but also issues of power and how cities can create their own powers to make and enforce bylaws. No matter what legal issues you're interested in, the certificate in law has you covered. Criminal law is a module of Law 201-701, Introduction to Canadian Law. And we also have a whole course about the Constitution, powers, and how they work in Canada. Law 205-705, Public and Constitutional Law. If you're a Queen's student, certificate courses may also be applied to your undergraduate credit requirements. You can find out more about these courses and sign up at takelaw.ca. So Kingston has a nuisance party bylaw, and this is something that I actually had confused with the University District Safety Initiative. They're two different things, but it seems like the University District Safety Initiative is kind of there to point in most significant ways, or many significant ways, to the bylaw.
Right. So the nuisance party bylaw is a separate bylaw passed by the city of Kingston, and it really provides a power to the police and an ability to lay additional charges. Its significance, because the nuisance party bylaw is the one that is not restricted under the University District Safety Initiative to only those certain times of year. So at any time that the police lay a charge under the nuisance party bylaw, it can and will be prosecuted by way of the University District Safety Initiative. The outstanding features of it are that, first of all, it gives the police, the chief of police or his delegate, which is basically going to be any officer that has been empowered to do so, the ability to declare a party a nuisance party at any time. Once that order has been issued, then all of the attendees must immediately leave the party. Following that, the city can issue to the property owner or to a tenant of the residence an order that they host no more parties for the next 2 years. If it happens within another 2 years, you don't need to give the warning. Any person can be instantly charged. So with respect to the question of who does it catch, the bylaw is very, very widely written. It can be the host of the party. You're also free to charge any attendee of the party, whether that's after the warning has been given or the fact that the party was precluded from the beginning. In addition to that, and if that weren't enough, the city was concerned about absentee landlords, so the owner can be charged, even if the landlord is in fact in China at the time. Any person that is an occupant of the resident can be charged, and any person that is a tenant of the party can be charged under the bylaw, even if the tenant was not involved in the party. So if you live there, if you rent there, you can be responsible and you can be charged.
The visual metaphor in my head is like charge. It's kind of like a t-shirt gun. They're just firing charges off willy-nilly, except no one wants the charge and most people want a t-shirt.
The only way that the analogy is not appropriate is, that's right, in this case, people would be fleeing from the t-shirts as opposed to trying to get them.
Right.
We've seen several situations where people, in fact, try to flee from the t-shirts. But it gives the police an ability to charge anybody that they find there, any attendee of the party. So typically what happens is people do scatter fairly quickly once the police show up and declare the party to be a nuisance party.
What's a party?
So, a party is basically any gathering at all, but there is a list of conduct under the nuisance party bylaw that is specifically designed, under the definition of party, of the kind of conduct that they are looking to prohibit.
Okay.
The primary indications of that would be a party featuring any public intoxication. So, a party that moves from being completely contained to being out on the streets. If the party involves any blocking of traffic or really has spilled out onto the streets, if we get into things like people urinating in public, then that's going to be deemed to be a gathering that is subject to the nuisance party bylaw. And significantly, and again, maybe misunderstood, But any rooftop party can be deemed to be a nuisance party unless the roof is specifically permitted to host large numbers of people. So the idea that I'm only having a few people on the roof, therefore it can't be a nuisance party, is probably incorrect. Very few roofs in the city of Kingston are zoned such that they can host a large number of people.
Right. And maybe I'm just being pedantic at this point, but if one of the outcomes of this is they say this domicile can't host a party for the next 2 years, is that only parties that trigger any of these other conditions, or is this anything that's deemed a party at all?
It's anything that has been deemed to be a party under the nuisance party by law, which again, the police have the power to do.
Right.
So really, it's a broad range of conduct that the police can say that constitutes a nuisance party. Effectively, it's almost anything that would make a party worth attending. But as soon as that happens, then the order can be issued. The party must stop immediately, or the charges could be laid. And I guess one of the ideas of going with owner liability is that it might not even be the same group of people that have been precluded from having a party there. If there is a landlord that rents to a group of students 1 year and those students all graduate and move on, you could be renting a house that is subject to the nuisance party bylaw without even knowing that you've done so, and you could end up facing charges simply because the people that were there the previous year had hosted a party deemed to be a nuisance party.
Right. So what counts, I'm assuming that we're not going to roll out the town crier and have a scroll. What counts as someone declaring something a nuisance party?
So again, that's specifically a power that is given to the police. So the police basically do need to pronounce loudly at the scene of the party, under the authority of the nuisance party bylaw, we are declaring this to be a nuisance party, and we are telling all attendees to disperse immediately.
Okay. So you do have to have law enforcement on site and a public declaration that this has been deemed a nuisance party.
That's correct.
Okay. So, and but that's the point where they can, is there a time limit? Like, do you get a head start before they start laying charges? Or is it, this is a nuisance party, and then the t-shirt cannon starts going off?
I think that the argument can clearly be made that they've got to give you fair warning. They've got to give you a reasonable length of time to disperse.
Right.
From my observations, that length of time is not very, very long. And of course, you're dealing with people that are already well into the party. And you're dealing with people that, generally speaking, they may be a mere attendee. They don't know the history of this house. They're probably unfamiliar with most of these laws. So sometimes it results in, let's just say, some attitude towards the police officers.
Right.
And where that occurs, that's one of the most surefire ways that you can be sure that you're the person that they're going to choose to charge by virtue of the fact that you were an attendee. We have seen situations where it is the innocent tenant that comes home that says, I had nothing to do with it. And faced with kind of that response, that's when the police may decide to lay a charge. So fairly, you need to be given some warning. I think that I could challenge a charge that was laid too soon, but it's not specified how much time they need to give for you to disperse or the party to end. It just better happen pretty darn quickly if you want to be on the safe side of the law.
So laddering all the way back up to kind of the broad myths, do you have to be a Kingston resident to be charged under this bylaw?
Not at all. You could be any individual that is at the party.
Okay.
So one of the features of homecoming is that many of the people, we call it homecoming for a reason, have come home for the weekend and may be visiting their friends, some of whom are still students. Those individuals can be charged.
Right.
Anybody that's at the party.
Okay. Because anecdotally, there are a lot of students from other universities that come down for homecoming because they hear it's going to be a fun time. And so there's a lot of non-Kingston residents. They can all be charged under this.
I think so. Queens students tend to feel a real loyalty to the school to which, to Queens and to the school to which they attended. And they have fond memories of their times as a student. That's why it's one of the most successful homecomings of any university in Ontario. At the same time, the University District Safety Initiative and the Nuisance Party Bylaw are responses to that very success.
Right. So is there anything else kind of that we need to cover in the Nuisance Party Bylaw?
Once under the nuisance party bylaw, there's really nothing else. Those, it's, you know, almost anything that is going to make the party notable is likely to trigger the potential that it could be declared a nuisance party.
Okay. So what's the big picture here in terms of have, from your vantage point, have, since this was implemented, Has there been a change in the type of and sort of scale of partying going on in the university, or has it kind of been the same but with more charges being laid?
I'm not so sure that there has been a significant change. The University District Safety Initiative, in the language that the city used to pass it, as well as in the preamble to the nuisance party bylaw, they talk an awful lot about that golden goal of any criminal or quasi-criminal law, which is deterrence.
Right.
I think that students and people that are attending parties don't particularly think deterrence. I don't think that they're thinking, oh, what are the consequences of this? People are simply out to have a good time. So from what I've seen, I'm not so sure that it has had a significant effect on cutting down the amount of the conduct. What has happened, however, is the police have tools to respond more quickly. So recently, there was an example where by 11 o'clock in the morning, the police had already attended. Admittedly, this party had already flown out onto the streets, but declared a nuisance party as of 11 o'clock in the morning. So what I think has happened is that the police have an ability to respond much quicker than they used to, and more tools for enforcement once they do.
Okay. And Queens Legal Aid has produced some tools to help students, well, help everyone really, understand what the parameters are. You produced some materials, I think, last year or the year before that were circulated on campus. They're available at queenslawclinics.ca on the Queens Legal Aid site. That basically detail kind of the parameters of what makes a party and what makes essentially what will lead you into violating these bylaws.
Yes, a summary of all of this information is up on our website, and we have produced those materials under the heading of Save the Party, Skip the Ticket. One of my messages about that is that it's not just a ticket that you're skipping.
Right.
It's the summons to court now that you are skipping and the larger fine that can come with it.
Right.
I think I would like to just remind people that although these are charges that can have, you know, a significant effects and are a pain to deal with, and they take the time to go to court, at the same time, we're still talking about bylaw offenses and provincial offenses. So the good news in all of this for a person that gets charged is you're not going to get a criminal record for this.
Okay.
You can get a criminal record for other things, such as obstruct police, if you were to give a police officer a false name when you are being arrested, or if you try to run away. But generally speaking, if you find yourself in a situation where you're charged, if you cooperate at that stage, the worst that you're looking at is this fine and the consequences that come along with it, but that doesn't involve a criminal record. Another aspect of the University District Safety Initiative that many students are concerned about, and here it specifically is students, is that part of the initiative is, in addition to the summons to court, the offenses are reported to Queen's University, who can then have a conduct investigation as to whether or not you have committed some sort of non-academic offense that can be disciplined. The good news is that we have not seen Queens vigorously coming after people for this. In some situations, depending on the notoriety of the party and kind of the scope of the harm to the community that may have been done, they have launched investigations, but typically those are resolved with either the student agreeing not to host a similar party or not to engage in such conduct again in the future, or even simply writing a letter of apology to the school. So it's not like anybody needs to worry that they will lose their degree, although some people are concerned that it can be reported to the university as well.
Right, and the university has its own sort of suite of powers. We can't guarantee what would happen if the university engages in a conduct review.
No, we can't. And again, that's not something that I think anybody would want to go through.
Right.
But it's not like the university has been coming with over-the-top sanctions for individuals that have been found to be in violation of the University District Safety Initiative.
Okay. So where can students go if they need help with these issues?
So this is one of the things that Queen's Legal Aid specifically does. We have a number of students down there that work under the supervision of lawyers, and provincial offenses and bylaws are squarely within the power for students to represent individual. We have a great deal of experience in doing so.
Great. Thank you very much, Blair.
It's been a pleasure.
Thanks to Blair Crewe. You can find lots more information about Queen's Legal Aid, including some resources on parties and the law, at queenslawclinics.ca. It's also a great resource for information on all of Queen's Law's clinics, including business law, family law, elder law, and the nation's only prison law clinic. If you're interested in our rights as citizens and the use of power in Canada, you can take a more profound look at the subject in Law 205-705, Public and Constitutional Law. You can learn more at takelaw.ca. Fundamentals of Canadian Law is recorded at Queen's University, situated on traditional Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee territory. Our theme music is by Megan Hamilton, who's also a staff member here at Queen's Law. You can find out more about her music at meganhamiltonmusic.wordpress.com. Thanks for listening. Welcome to Fundamentals of Canadian Law. I'm Matt Shepard. Spring is in the air, and right alongside flowers, for rent signs are blooming across Canada. Students are signing leases and setting up sublets. So we sat down with Blair Crew, the director of Queen's Legal Aid, to get the whole picture on landlords, leases, and the law. Whether you're signing a lease, subletting an apartment, or seeking new roommates, there's a lot you need to know. We should mention that this is not legal advice and is being presented for informational purposes only. Also, this was recorded in April of 2019, and the law is always subject to change. This podcast is brought to you by the Queen's Certificate in Law, the only online certificate in law offered by a law faculty in Canada. You can find out more at takelaw.ca. I'm here with Blair Crew, who is the director of Queen's Legal Aid, which is located in downtown Kingston and is part of Queen's Law School. This, for me, it's a build out a bit of things I learned in the property module in Law 201, taught by Dean Bill Flanagan. And in that module, we get a bit into landlords and leasing and rentals. But we're going to get into that, especially since we're in spring and summer right now. We're going to get into that in a bit more depth.
That sounds great. Thank you for having me on the podcast.
Leasing is something that sort of happens at a provincial level. I used to live in Quebec, and I recall that they had fairly stringent rules that you had to have leases that ended on July 1st, which meant there was a peak moving season. So my understanding from that moving forward is that every province kind of sets its own rules for landlords and leasing.
That's right. Leasing is really a development of common law where a landlord who has a bundle of rights, as often we talk about property rights, will by contract take a portion of those rights or some sticks from the bundle and pass them on to someone else for a limited time. The best known model, of course, is a person that owns a building that wants to lease it out to someone that's going to rent for a while as a tenant. Property and civil rights in a province is a matter of provincial jurisdiction under the Constitution. So that means that each province is free to legislate however it sees fit over top of what the common law says.
And sir, we're located in Kingston, Ontario, so we're going to be talking pretty specifically about stuff that's happening in Kingston and stuff that's happening in Ontario. But with the exception of Quebec, can we kind of take it as a given that things are fairly similar across the country? If someone's listening in Manitoba or BC, can they expect kind of the same things to apply?
Every province is going to be governed by its own equivalent of the Residential Tenancies Act, but all of the common law provinces have enacted legislation that regulates residential tenancies, and by and large, those generally follow a similar model. Now, there may be individual rights or individual peculiarities that apply to one jurisdiction but not another, and I wouldn't want to touch upon what happens in Quebec. But apart from that, generally many of the rights that have been created by statute are similar from province to province.
Okay, so let's talk about leasing. You're the landlord. I'm a student or another person. You have a property. I want to live in it. Kind of what happens at that point legally?
So the landlord and the tenant will agree together on what the terms of that lease are going to be. And one of the peculiarities of Ontario is as of April the 1st, 2018, the government has mandated that there is now one standard residential lease form. And the purposes of this was really to educate both landlords and tenants as to their rights, because there was a lot of poor understanding. I think people have a very common law feel for what they they can and cannot do. And there are so many individual rights that are given or are limited, depending on your perspective, under the Residential Tenancies Act, that finally the government said, let's just make the obligations on both sides clear to everybody by having a standard form lease, which is mandatory for all new tenancy agreements.
So that's been since, essentially, it's been about a year now since that was introduced. And so now there is just one set of obligations on both sides.
That's correct. And I think that anybody that is coming to sign a new lease or is beginning university or is moving to a new town, they're going to be confronted with the realities of that standard lease form that set out all the basic rights and obligations. Now, there is room for an individual landlord and tenant to make a contractual arrangement for added provisions, but one of the fundamental premises of the Ontario Residential Tenancies Act is that you cannot contract out of the Act, meaning if there is a provision that is provided in legislation, that's not a matter of individual negotiation between the landlord and tenant.
Right. So, I mean, one of the things that comes up, or something that comes up fairly frequently, is this idea of kind of landlord rules or house rules. The classic example from old films is, you know, a woman in a boarding house can't have any gentleman callers. So do landlords have the right to actually create these kinds of provisions?
So outside of the stuff that's legislated, landlords do have the right to create individual provisions. But one of the fundamental things that landlords can't do actually is limit the number of people that live in the house or who's permitted to have guests. Every tenant, one of the things that landlords fundamentally often don't understand is that when they are renting out the place, by and large, they are giving up for a period of time the majority of their rights to that place. And one of the things that they can't limit is a person's ability to have guests over. And that could be short-term or that could be long-term. Landlords may sometimes say yes, but there's five people there instead of four, so it's using more utilities. That's why I want to restrict it. The landlord would be free to say, if you have an additional guest for a period of time, I may charge more for utilities if that's the landlord's responsibility. But one of the things the landlord can't do under the legislation is say who somebody is allowed to have older. So that classic example would no longer be something that the landlord could do. On the other hand, there are no provisions in the Residential Tenancies Act about whether or not you can make a building a no-smoking building. So if an individual landlord wants to include a term that says this building is smoke-free, the landlord and tenant can agree to that as a term of their contract.
One thing that comes up a lot is non-human guests. So can a landlord say yes or no to pets?
Non-human guests are often one of the biggest concerns, and I think from a landlord's point of view, there's a large concern because they're going to, if it's a cat, scratch up everything, or if it's a dog, you know, going to leave a mess all over the place. One of the provisions of the Ontario Residential Tenancies Act, and this is not universal amongst all the provinces, is that a no-pet provision is void. So even if it's there in the contract, or even if the landlord feels that they can negotiate that as an individual aspect, that's one of those provisions that contravenes the Act, and it cannot be enforced.
Okay.
So you're free to have your cat or dog as much as you want.
Oh, so let's talk about kind of the evolution of this idea of guests, because that extends into something that's of immediate concern to a lot of students as the summer approaches, which is subletting. And not having a guest on the property, but basically having someone there in your place, probably paying the rent to you, the tenant, and then you turn that money in exchange over to the landlord. What are the rights and obligations of someone who wants to sublet an apartment?
So at common law, the rights were very, very, very open-ended, and both what the landlord and tenant can do or not do by way of subletting is one of the areas where there's many provisions in the legislation. So when a person sublets, when a tenant sublets, basically it's as if the tenant is now passing on some of the individual rights that they have received from that bundle of rights to a person that holds through a contract through them. So it's like a second level contract. When you sublet, though, you don't do anything to extinguish the obligations of the tenant. So the tenant and the subtenant can agree to any rent that they want. The legislation says that can't be more than the rent that the tenant themselves is paying. So that puts an upward cap on how much they can charge. The legislation also says that a landlord needs to consent to the subtenant, but cannot unreasonably withhold that consent. So if a tenant comes to a landlord and says, I'll be gone for the summer, but here's a graduate student that will be in town for the summer, I'd like to sublet to them, the landlord cannot unreasonably refuse that. But if the subtenant then subsequently trashes the place or doesn't pay rent to the tenant, that in no way relieves the tenant who has sublet from their obligations. So when you choose to sublet, you're still really retaining responsibility for the tenancy yourself. And if anything goes wrong with your subtenant, that's a matter between you and the subtenant. Your obligations to the landlord still survive.
So it doesn't feel like there's a difference here between whether you inform the landlord or not. I mean, informing the landlord is obviously probably a good idea and a polite thing to do, but it doesn't remove any obligations from the tenant if they tell the landlord what's happening. Saying, hey, I'm subletting this place, doesn't remove any obligation from me as a tenant. I still assume all the obligations I normally would.
That's correct. And so now, and because there's no relationship, no contractual relationship between the subtenant and the landlord individually. Now, the law recognizes that landlords may want to know who it is that's residing in their premises. They want to make sure that this is a person that's allowed to stay there and not someone that's breaking in and stealing your stuff, for example. They may want to know who's been provided with a key to the building. So that's why the legislation says that the landlord, you need landlord consent to sublet, but that the landlord cannot withhold that consent unless there's a really strong reason, you know, such as, for example, the landlord finds out that this subtenant had trashed three previous places or something of that nature.
Right. So the key takeaway for me in this is a student shouldn't be concerned about telling their landlord that they're going to sublet because the landlord can't reasonably refuse unless there's a very good reason to do so.
That's right. And really, the idea of subletting, too, is that the tenant is usually going to resume their tenancy when they come back in the fall.
Right.
So you don't want to do anything to extinguish your rights. Otherwise, you shouldn't be concerned. The legislation does give the tenant the right to terminate the tenancy altogether if they come to the landlord with a subtenant and the landlord says, no, I refuse to do that, or I will never allow a sublet. But that's not always in a student's interest because often they want the place back when they come back.
Right.
I'd also like to mention something about the notion of joint and several liability. It's very common in university towns, and I think the new form of lease, because there's spots for multiple tenants on it, lends itself to this, that instead of a landlord having an individual lease, say, for a room with each tenant, it's common for four or six tenants, particularly in Kingston, where there's lots of nice old houses around, to have a single lease document where all four or six tenants will sign together. When you create a tenancy together with four or six or one or two, I mean, or two signatures together, that creates a relationship of joint and several liability. What effectively means is that each of those tenants is responsible to the landlord for the full obligations of the contract. In theory, if one of the six tenants were not to pay their share of rent, the landlord is free to come to the other five tenants and say, hey, your sixth tenant didn't pay up. I want you guys to split that amount up. Or even to pick on one tenant that they perceive to have deeper pockets and say, hey, this is a joint and several contract. You're fully responsible for the full amount, so I'm going to come after you for the amount that your other co-tenant didn't pay. Similarly, if there is damage caused by any one of the people that is on that contract, typically landlords will do a move-out inspection at the end. If that happens and they find damage, the landlord is free to sue all four or six individuals, how many ever there are, or is free to sue only one. And even if somebody else caused the damage, in law, you could be responsible for it. So it's something I always think is worthwhile for students to know.
We get pick your roommates carefully.
Absolutely. And there are an awful lot of times where relationships start out great with roommates and they sort of go badly. And there are services available to the Queen's University that will help you to mediate those co-tenant disputes before it gets to the stage of needing to involve the law.
Actually, since you mentioned the landlord walkthrough upon the end of a tenancy, is first and last illegal in Ontario?
Yeah, the only amounts that a landlord can charge by way of what they used to call a security deposit is charging a first and last month's rent. Now, first month's rent is literally to pay for the first month of the tenancy. The other deposit can be no more than the last month's rent deposit. The landlord must pay interest on it at a rate that is prescribed by legislation every year, and it must be applied to the last month's rent. So the notion of a damage deposit, that's something that is precluded by Ontario law. The only other amount a landlord could charge up front, it would be a key deposit. It must be a refundable deposit, and that can be no more than the actual amount that it would cost the landlord to replace the keys.
We're referring to the legislation a lot. It's easily accessible, right?
Yes, it's the Residential Tenancy Act, and it's available through e-laws. Also, the Landlord and Tenant Board of Ontario, which is the specialized tribunal that has jurisdiction over most landlord-tenant disputes in Ontario, has excellent information on their website. And including self-help guides and an explanation of the law, as well as link to all of the relevant legislation and regulations.
And this is all very accessible and understandable stuff. You can read this, and this isn't lawyerese. It's not very opaque. It's all been put in a format that's pretty easy to parse.
Yeah, the legislation itself is still legislation, and
right.
Sometimes legislation is drafted in a way that could be clearer, certainly, but part of what the Landlord and Tenant Board website does is try to put it into plain language, and that's something else that they've really emphasized with the new standard lease, is that it's a plain language lease, and all of those old clauses that, you know, repeat everything and have Latin phrases and phrases repeated in triplicate, that's all done away with now.
Right. So if I wanted to sublet, would it be in my interest, even informally, to try to get some sort of contract in writing between myself and the person I'm subleasing to?
It's always so if you are now effectively in the position of the landlord vis-a-vis your subtenant.
Right.
So it's always a good idea to get a written agreement as to what the contractual obligations are. Now, the Residential Tenancies Act has very few provisions about that, apart from the fact that you can't charge more rent. But for example, we talked before about a landlord that would have a no smoking rule. You'd want to make sure that in your contract with your subtenant, you're repeating that rule. Otherwise, you will be violating your obligations to the landlord. You may also want to put provisions in there that specify that the subtenant would pay for damage if any is caused, or that if the landlord subsequently comes back and alleges that the subtenant caused damage, that's something that the subtenant will make the tenant whole for. It's much better to have it in writing, because that relationship is one that is much more contractual in nature than property in nature, and you want to be able to prove to the small claims court, which is where there would be jurisdiction over this, if there's any dispute about what the obligations were.
So what can you do if you get into trouble, if something goes wrong with your subtenancy and so on? Where do you go to kind of seek help with these sorts of issues?
So one of the difficulties with a subtenant is that the Landlord-Tenant Board itself doesn't have jurisdiction over subtenancies. So if you need a legal remedy as against a subtenant, you're ultimately going off to the small claims court. That said, you'd want to find some legal advice, and legal clinics, including Queen's Legal Aid, would be happy to assist in some of those disputes, just to help explain what your rights are and what your remedies from there are if something has gone wrong.
Excellent. And let's hope nothing does.
Let's hope not.
Thank you, Blair.
You're very welcome.
Thanks to Blair Crew, Director of Queen's Legal Aid. Property law, including landlords and leases, is part of our sampler tray of Canadian law, Law 201, 701, Introduction to Canadian Law. You can find out more about that course at takelaw.ca. Fundamentals of Canadian Law is recorded at Queen's University, situated on traditional Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee territory. Our theme music is by Megan Hamilton, who's also a staff member here at Queen's Law. You can find out more about her music at meganhamiltonmusic.wordpress.com. Original illustrations for this podcast are by Valerie Desrochers. You can find her work at vdesrochers.com. Thanks for listening. Con- contracts, workplace rights, trademarks, even your digital identity online. Law is an everyday part of life, and having knowledge about these topics can help you become a more informed citizen. That's why Queen's is offering the Certificate in Law, an online program designed to provide a foundational understanding of Canadian law through a series of fascinating courses. Discover if law is right for you. To find out more, visit takelaw.ca.
Are you looking for a summer or part-time job? On Tuesday, January 28th, over 40 employers will be in Bartlett Gym in Mitchell Hall. All Queen's students from all programs and years are invited. All students who attend will be entered into a draw for a $50 gift card to the Great Lakes Museum. Students are encouraged to sign up in My Career to receive event reminders.
CFRC 101.9 FM has new social media. Find us on Instagram and Facebook at CFRC Music and keep up with the latest announcements about our programming and projects. Follow us today at CFRC Music.
What's that like, the taste of butter? A pretty dress. What's that like to live deliciously?
Join me, your host, Chris, for The Witching Hour live on CFRC 101.9 FM every Wednesday at 12 a.m. where you can get your weekly dose of metalcore, post-hardcore, crying, screaming, and sometimes throwing up.
Oh my God!
Oh my God!
They say nothing good happens after midnight, but why not stay a while and find out?
Coming up now on this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office, we're pleased to present a new single by Nolan Hubbard and Sit Still called Pollen. Pollen is about embracing growth and confidently moving on from the things holding you back. Sonically, it unfolds gradually. Bouncy bass lines, lush vocal harmonies, swirling indie rock guitars, and dynamic production works together that bring the track into full bloom. Hubbard's distinctively stylish vocals, paired with Sit Still's rhythmic prowess, create a vibrant musical collaboration. Want to be highlighted next time? Complete the Release Radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via Visit Kingston.music on Instagram. In the meantime, stream Pollen by Nolan Hubbard and Sit Still on your favorite platforms and enjoy it with us here now on CFRC 101.9 FM.
Keep inhaling all the pollen. I don't need you in my garden. Misbehaving, stop installing. Don't be hating, I'm not calling. Didn't think I'd make the cut. See me now, things looking up. Used to be so in a rush. I was stressing out, I was losing touch. Used to think I'd never see this person I turn out to be. But now I've got this energy, so keep your shade away from me. Thought that we'd grow into something beautiful, but it wasn't mine to hold. No, the water doesn't flow. Keep inhaling all the pollen. I don't need you in my garden. You got pride creeping through the weeds. Get the worst on my seeds. Misbehaving, stop installing. Don't be hating, I'm not calling. Don't tell me I spill my cup. When I'm dreaming, don't wake me up.
GradChat is a collaboration between the SGS and CFRC, where we feature one graduate student or postdoc each week, providing them the platform to showcase their research and explain how it affects us. We also occasionally do interviews with postdocs, alumni, or grad students on topical subjects. Are you a grad student, postdoc, or alumni that would like to be interviewed? Visit queensu.ca/sgs/grad-chat to fill out the interviewee form. You can listen to Grad Chat every Tuesday at 4 to 4:30 p.m.
Morning, students. Question. If Queen's doesn't offer its workers a fair contract by February 3rd, who will be affected? Anyone? Answer. Those who live in residence, use university facilities, eat in campus cafeterias, and attend classes and labs.
So basically everyone.
Correct. It's time for Queen's to take responsibility and ensure the well-being of their workers and students.
Message brought to you by QP Locals 229-254 and 1302.
Wouldn't it be cool if you could volunteer with Canada's oldest campus radio station? Well, sign up to volunteer with CFRC 101.9 FM today. We're always looking for new volunteers, and we offer a free training program, so no experience in radio production is necessary. You can start your own radio show or podcast, contribute to our news collective, help us sort through music sent to us by record labels and artists, help plan events, record PSAs for us, and even more. Reach out to our programming manager, Alex Fernandez, via email at programs@CFRC.ca.